What is love but podcasting enduring? This is the Awesome Cast. Hello and welcome to the Awesome Cast, your podcast for everything awesome. I'm Basil.
I'm Kevin.
I'm Douglas.
I'm still Charlie.
And that's still us. Thank you everyone for coming and listening and putting us into those wonderful ear location devices. We're glad you're here to listen to us and for us to tell you where you can find us, even though you're already listening to us, because there's other places we have besides the audio stuff. Why? We have a Discord that you can come and tell us and give us comments, or when we ask for questions, you could certainly ask your questions there. Or if you want to give us money, and we'd love it if you do, we do have a Patreon that's always accepting that cold hard cash. Also, if you could leave us a 5-star review, whatever podcatcher that you happen to use, or even the ones that you don't, if they're the 5 stars, we don't really care. And all that's important because we bring you the news that you need to know, like farts are coming to Animal Crossing.
What?
So, what they're doing is they're introducing whoopee cushions for April 1st. And so, as of the time this episode should theoretically be released, we'll be in the time frame of March 26th to April 1st, where you can go onto the little Nook phone and go to your little Nook shopping on the phone, and one of those tabs is going to have whoopee cushions in various colors.
My God.
They did it!
Yeah, they really did it. I really recommend, Nintendo has some great pictures of people freaking the hell out because they sat on a whoopee cushion. So, I don't know if we're going to get the actual Primo fart sound, but God, I hope so.
It's telling, I feel, that their big April Fool's thing is a prank that literally hasn't been funny in like 70 years.
I mean, you say that, but
in the world of Animal Crossing, it's exciting, fresh, and new.
And it's followed up by prom.
What?
Yeah, you'll be able to get prom items pretty soon, too. Yeah. Yeah, they announced that. There was also
your villagers to prom?
Yeah, man. You'll be able to buy various, like, tuxedos and dresses and new shoes.
Oh, no.
And various, like, tiaras and crowns.
There's going to be so many YouTube promposal videos.
Oh, God.
Made in this game.
Yeah, it's going to be great. And
no.
They're also adding in, I think, an extra 50 slots for custom designs.
Oh, my.
Which pretty much doubles up the amount of custom designs that you can technically have on your file. And you'll be able to actually look through those things through the phone. Like the normally you have to go into the Able Sisters shop to go to the kiosk to do all that stuff, but they're going to be just putting on the Nook phone in the game, which is pretty cool.
Okay, that's pretty good.
So yeah, now Animal Crossing is going to be all exciting and stuff pretty soon. But other exciting things are things like Moments of Awesome.
It's a moment of awesome.
Moments of Awesome, things that may not get a whole episode yet, but things we really want to talk about. Like the thing that Kevin's about to tell us about right now.
Oh, wait, I said I was ready, and I am, because I want to talk about, briefly, Grimgar of Fantasy and Ash, the light novels.
Ooh.
By Ao Chumonji. I can't remember if I ever talked about the anime on here, or if any of us ever did.
I might have. I really
but
liked
it's,
it.
Yeah, the anime is really good, and I'm surprised that it took me so long to pick up any of the light novels. But it's you know, basic idea is, you know, it's got kids go to another world, go off on fantasy adventures, but the twist is they're shockingly average. They're pretty regular people. They also have no memories of our world, if that's even where they're from, although it is. But, and, you know, there's really nothing for this world you could do except become an adventurer. And the Adventurer Guild is happy to front you alone to go get trained in a class so you can go out and probably get killed by goblins in the first 5 minutes.
It's like a beautiful take on Goblin Slayer without Goblin Slayer and with the goblins significantly less rapey.
Which is always good. But the anime only really covers basically what amounts to the first two novels, minus a chunk at the beginning of the second novel, which I wish they had animated because it involves a cool orc raid on the city. But, yeah. In any case, although it's definitely inspired by video games, RPGs, and even the author has listed things like Wizardry and Ultima, like, you know, the hard video game RPGs as inspirations. But it definitely has, our heroes are not the cool, awesome heroes. Like, that's another party. They run into them sometimes. They're having way more fun than they are. They are fighting monsters, finding cool magical weapons, saving the day, doing cool things. Our heroes are struggling for an level one adventure for 4 to 6 players, you know. Although, as the novels go on, although they never quite lose that feeling of we are like not even second best, we're probably like third or fourth best, they do get better and they do get more skilled. But it is also kind of a dark series. Things happen very early on in the story. A prominent character dies. And it's not the only death in their life or the only time their party gets rearranged. And they go through some shit. And eventually, it even kind of breaks up the... the status quo. The first few volumes are... They go someplace. They do some stuff there. Just they start to get comfortable. Some new terrible thing shows up that they barely survive. They go back home. Repeat. It eventually kind of breaks that status quo. It's 8 volumes in out of what are 16 at the moment available. They are nowhere near the city they're normally in. They're on the whole wrong end of the continent, and they're not even sure how to get back. And they are definitely not equipped or leveled to grind the mobs and where they're at. As much as I'm using video game terminology, I'm almost done, but what I really like about the series is that nobody feels like they have levels or hit points, or, you know, no skills aren't just selected from a menu kind of feel. It's like the classes feel like jobs. They had to go take a few weeks to get just the basics of their class. So they have to go back and get trained to learn skills. And once they've learned the skill, they haven't mastered it. They can't do it perfect every time. They got to keep using it. They got to practice. They got to use it in real life situations to start to get good with it. And even, you know, as they start to, they can even figure out the synergy in their different skills and how they can combine them together to best effect. It really that does give it more of this tabletop RPG feel. These are real people struggling in a tabletop RPG world where the game master does not care if the role goes bad for you. And it's
how do you enjoy the translation?
I'm liking it. There are some odd choices, but...
Well, I know, for example, I read that time I got reincarnated as a slime. I read those light novels. I know they're translated by Kevin Gifford, and he has done like lots of role-playing games like Tales of and a lot of JRPG stuff. He's done translation work. I think he's worked on some of the Dragon Quests over time. So he gets it, but I also know that the translations that they go with the light novels doesn't always match up what shows up on the anime for, like, Crunchyroll and stuff.
Yeah.
And so there can be some disconnect there, and it's probably just because there's no, like, major lore book, you know, by Fuse or anything for slime stuff, so...
Right.
It's based on probably what they're hearing, what they're interpreting, you know, the kanji, and, you know...
There are some differences, although... the anime version has like some slightly different art style, and I think some slightly different characterization in some cases, which is fine. I don't think Yume talks as much in the third person in the anime as she does in the novel, which is weird, but...
And how does it feel, Kevin, to now know that you're one of the chosen, you're one of the elite? You read the light novels.
I read a fair number of light novels, although a lot of what I have read as light novels are stuff that didn't have an anime adaptation, although some of them I wish would get an anime adaptation. Or alternately, now I kind of wish Grimgar would get more anime adaptation, although probably the window is closed on that one.
I mean, we're still getting more slime animation, so never say never, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I would like to see the immediate follow-up of where the anime got to, and farther, if possible, but... And I'd very desperately like Haruhiro, our main protagonist, to realize he is starting to get a little bit awesome. He wouldn't believe it if you told him, but he's starting to get a little bit awesome 8 volumes in.
Oh, it took 8 volumes.
Took 8 volumes for what most isekai protagonists achieve in 2 or 3 chapters.
All right, Doug, I'm going to give you the choice of defaulting or eggs.
I'm going to go with bravely default.
Cool. Let's keep this role-playing train a-rolling.
I have been way into Bravely Default 2, and it is so good, you guys. So good. I'm not at the big twist yet. I don't know what the big twist is going to be or when it's going to hit, but I know I'm not there yet because I don't feel like a big twist has happened, but I'm really into it. So far, the biggest twist has been that the card game that they introduce, Monster Go, is pretty awesome. In fact, right. I think I may want to talk about Monster Go being, like, the best incarnation of, like, a Square Enix card game I've yet seen.
Right. There's a card game? You must be in there farther than I am.
Okay, Kevin, it's optional. It's starting in somewhere, I think, right after Chapter 2.
Yeah, it's in the second town. Like, after you do all the stuff for the second town, it is then in the second town.
I must have just missed this completely.
You probably did. Go back and check. I assure you that it's there.
Huh.
That's also where you get one of the optional jobs. And, if you go... Now, sometimes, you know, when you get onto the town map and you click in the button to pull up the map, it'll show you all the potential side quests.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't show up that it's in that building, because it's technically in its own little map.
Huh.
So you have to go there, talk to the lady, and then she'll be like, oh, nah, if you want to deal with my stuff, you got to play some B&D. Because it's Bravely and Default, but it's pretty much plays like Go, but with monsters.
Yes. Wow. Monster Go.
I completely missed what sounds like an amusing side game.
It's so good. And this is just the side game within the game. Like, the actual game is also pretty good, but I feel like if you played Bravely Default, you already know that it's good. And possibly if you have not... I only played about halfway through the first Bravely Default. I didn't actually beat it. And I didn't play any of the other Bravely Default follow-ups. So if you're worried that you had to have played all these other games before you can jump into this game, that is not the case. It is following the Final Fantasy patterns of evidently being set in a completely different world with entirely different characters. So, yeah, I have no reason to suspect that there's going to be a big twist in there other than just, you know, I've been playing JRPGs all my life. That's kind of how they do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know yet myself, but...
Like, oh my god, wouldn't that be actually the best twist of all, is that there is no twist? have we gotten so meta that it can just do an honest, genuine, straightforward, high fantasy adventure without doing any subversive twists, and it would be just so incredibly good?
Yeah, I'm enjoying it a lot, although I keep dividing my attention amongst other games, although I have been playing a good bit of Bravely Default too.
So all the job classes have new character designs. I kind of don't like the White Mage character design because the outfit has a little bit more of like a snow theme to it than the traditional white and red triangles. But they're all still very pretty. Beastmaster is evidently the best class.
Well, that's the class that you can sort of, if you've got the right monsters captured, you can break any fight.
Yeah, I found that out very quick. I'm only at the third town and I've already figured that out. Like, Beastmaster, as far as I can tell, is best class, and like it's also the cutest, so I don't know why you would play anything else.
Well, you gotta level up all your classes.
Although move on to do anything else until you max out that class for every character. It's why I'm still only about to leave level or chapter 3, and I'm level 50 for everybody.
I don't think
you're playing it right, Basil.
I'm
just saying what I was doing.
All four heroes, I ground Freelancer until everyone got the JP up skills.
Now, I am thinking about doing that. I tend to switch back to Freelancer, unequip all my equipment, like reduce everybody back down to like their absolute base job thing every time I get like the level up items, like the things where you can level up your job without having to fight, and you can level up specific stats, like, you know, add +1 to your HP, add +1 to your strength, like I do.
Oh, I see. So you see where everybody is.
Yeah, I see where everybody is actually at before I level them, but, because otherwise, if you stick to what job they have equipped and what equipment they have equipped, you'll get a distorted sense, and I feel that unequipping everybody periodically and re-equipping everybody, like, actually give you a better feel of what they can actually do. And also, don't trust the auto-equip. Like, it has an auto-equip button, but it lies. Don't trust it. It's wrong. Like, it'll tell you that your best equipment is this staff, and the staff is not the best piece of equipment that you have.
Well, I wonder if it also has to take, because this is a game where weight's actually important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that also, you know, so even if you get, like, some cool, awesome sword ahead of time, because you overlevel your character so you could fight an optional boss before you're supposed to be able to fight the optional boss, it may not be the weapon to equip for a few levels just yet anyways.
Yeah, weight actually is important. So you have to balance your weapon with your armor. So usually my preference is I want to put the baddest weapon on my character and then strip away their armor to the bare essentials of what can they put on and still carry around this awesome sword. But usually there's like at least one character where I need to do the opposite of that. And the auto put everything on just doesn't take any of that into account. Like, yeah, I think
also speed can be really important sometimes.
Yeah.
Particularly, at least for me, I've been finding the Godspeed strike that comes with the thief.
Is pretty good
at taking down bosses. And it does more damage the higher your speed is.
That's how I've been wrecking things left and right, is making sure I at least have one character who is thief or someone else with a high innate speed. And just like from the get-go, if it's got like various, like, mobs that, you know, along with the boss that need to die, I'll just brave it all out, Godspeed strike it, and then take them out as fast as I can before I move on.
Yeah, there's a lot more braving in this game than it feels like there was in the last time. I don't know, maybe I was playing the last one wrong, but this time it feels like I'm pretty much braving, maxing out my brave every single time at the beginning of the fight.
It really depends on how I'm doing it. Like, if I am trying to maximize getting my GP stuff going on and I'm using bait,
mm-hmm.
I will clear the field except for leave one enemy, then default a lot, kill the enemy, so that way I can go in wave two with full brave.
Oh.
And so I can wipe that out. Then I'm within, then it's round three if I'm lucky, and usually I'll spend the rest there and maybe wave four if I really get lucky to maximize my GP growth. But this is a lot of talk that'll clearly now eventually get its own episode.
Probably.
So,
well, before we even started the show, we were all kind of like arguing over who's going to get to do Bravely Default 2, and you guys have graciously let it be my moment of awesome because I don't have anything else going on.
Like, well, you say that, but the other episode I know is coming up at some point is Wonder Egg Priority. Which,
oh, I just went and watched that episode, and that hit so close to home.
The most recent one?
Yeah.
I honestly was thinking about you. I was honestly thinking about you when I watched it.
All of the angles you can possibly address this issue. All of them, all at once. Oh.
It's like the heaviest episode of the show, too, so far.
Yeah, but I think only so far. Like, I think this is still, like, episode two of the gear up for the big reveal.
So, yeah, Wonder Egg Priority is this anime. It's by ostensibly a studio, Cloverworks, but the folks that are, like, doing it are a lot of young up-and-comers as far as anime goes, and apparently they're just doing their best and working on this show so hard to make sure that it's good. And so far, it's there. And it's very much, for me, Madoka Magica crawled so this anime could run.
Yeah.
I did not realize I was watching a dark magical girl show until a few episodes in. Because that's not how they present this show. It's more of a straight up, like, alternate world psychological horror thing, but with a pretty heavy emphasis on the psychological part. And it wasn't until like a few episodes in I realized, wait, they all have their own unique weapons. There's clearly a pseudo team of multiple girls who seem to have magical powers, and they're getting stronger. These are magical girls. This is a dark magical girl show.
Yeah. Like, what if we use our, you know, magical fighting battles to just frame various teenage issues? But and I've enjoyed it immensely.
I'm really hoping that this is the anime that will catch on for folks. I am very scared that we might be, I am almost scared that we're stuck in a Stars Align situation, except this isn't a sport that no one cares about. And so that might give it the edge for it. It's another dark magical girl show. Therefore, people might actually be watching this show.
Like, all the girls got problems. Some of the problems are worse than other. Well, not worse. Some of the problems are bigger than other problems, but they're all problems, and it helps them. They help each other. And
they help other girls. With
and they help
problems.
Other girls with other problems. Yeah.
And it's
If you were a teenager ever, these problems are relatable problems. Except for the girl whose problem is that she's too smart and rich. Those problems aren't very relatable, but
the other ones.
Problems.
So, on that note, what teenager problems that you have, Charlie, that are relatable?
I've got hair coming in down there. having to put on deodorant every day now. It's a mess.
It is. So hopefully there's something awesome in your life that you can have a moment about to help counteract
that.
Oh,
sure, yeah, why not? Mine is a real old moment of awesome. It's a moment of oldsome, and it's current as something that got brought up today, actually, thanks to a guy on Twitter called Pixel Dan, who posted a YouTube video about a toy line called Meteorbs that came out in 1987, was part of the He-Man and the Masters of the Universe line, but is nothing like any of the other toys released for He-Man. They're like these little eggs that you open up the shell of them, pull out like the leg, unfold like the legs and the head or tail or whatever, and you've got an animal of some sort, a lion. There was a lion, a tiger, a rhino, that sort of thing. But the reason that I, and this was, see, 1987, He-Man came out in like 1984, but what makes it interesting to me that I did not realize, because I actually had a couple of these, is that Mattel actually licensed them from Bandai. It was a Japanese toy line called Tamagoras, and supposedly Bandai still makes them to this day. And yeah, and some of them are apparently very collectible, because I was just doing a quick browse, and like, you've got people selling some for like some of the vintage ones for like hundreds of dollars. And all of them are pretty much the same in that it's an egg that they've gotten bigger and they've gotten a little more complicated and detailed, but it's still basically, it's an egg. You open it up, unfold a head, legs, tail, and whatever, and then you've got an animal of some sort. And it's just one of those weird, like, it always strikes me when there's something that I enjoyed as a small child that ends up somehow having some link to like a Japanese franchise or toy line or whatever, that is, it makes something that I thought I only liked as a kid sort of relevant to my interests today. And I always find that interesting.
That is interesting. Like, seeing how all the pieces are connected.
Yeah. Yeah, the things that, like, you end up as an adult, like, you're into anime or you're into whatever, and then, like, you are reminded of something that laid the groundwork for that, that actually was the thing that you currently enjoy, and you just mm-hmm. didn't know it at the time. So, mm-hmm. like, it's like, this is how you subconsciously ended up here.
I mean, growing up with NES games, that was like,
oh yeah,
most games.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's, and something else that we grew up with were Marvel Comics. So we're just going to use that as a little segue, because our main topic of conversation is, man, about all sorts of things. It's about nostalgia and comics and, oh, well, it's called WandaVision. You probably have already seen it, but we're going to talk about it. We'll be right back. This is the Awesome Cast.
Oh, a newly wed couple just moved to town. A regular husband and wife who left the big city to find a quiet life. WandaVision. She's a magical gal in a small town locale. He's a homie who's part machine. How will this duo fit in and pull through? Oh, by sharing a love like you've never seen. WandaVision.
This all started clearly back on May 8th in 2008. And that was when we released the Awesome Cast episode about Iron Man, which happened to be the first movie that we now know as the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
That was a good movie.
It was a good movie.
It is a good movie.
And it set up a whole lot of, you know, dominoes, and they've all fallen and toppled and falling back on top of each other, and it's all, in some ways, has now coalesced in this brand new show that just aired on Disney Plus called WandaVision.
So, can we just talk for a moment before we go into, like, the specifics? Just
sure.
How good this show is. This show is just so good.
It is 100 times better than it has any right to be.
Yeah.
It is,
like,
the Cobra Kai of
good.
Our times.
Because you
Cobra
don't
Kai,
expect
the Cobra Kai of our time.
Well, yes. Sorry, keep going. Kyle, keep going.
You don't expect a TV miniseries based off of a movie franchise. There should be no expectation that such a thing would be good. Even if it's Disney behind it, one of the most successful media companies in history, because these are also the folks that can't keep DuckTales on TV for more than a few seasons, and created the dizzying tonal shift between The Last Jedi and The Rise of Skywalker. Like, well, they can screw things up.
Yeah.
I think, as I mentioned in our notes beforehand, the second best Kevin might just be Kevin Feige.
Yeah.
Who is the head up of Marvel Studios, and it's almost his singular vision to keep all the Marvel stuff straight, which is why we can have a show quite like this.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think this was his idea for the show that he pitched to other people to get made. Because while he is a big fan of movies, he is also someone probably much like us who also grew up with Nick at Night and all these old classic sitcoms. And he thought he definitely wanted a show that somehow could incorporate that, enter Wanda Maximoff and the Vision.
Mm.
Where he thought it'd be really cool to sort of tell their post-endgame story, but as a series of sitcoms. And wow, did it work for a whole lot of reasons.
Yeah.
For me, the thing that just continually just kept blowing my mind, like, every time I saw it, was the end credits theme. Like, every time I saw the end credits theme, it just got better and better and better. And, oh my god, it's just such a concise demonstration of how masterfully put together this whole thing was.
I think, the thing that clicked with me from the first episode, the thing that really drew me in was, it was little stuff, but in particular, it was the change of aspect ratio.
Yeah.
Where it was like the old school ratio for the actual show, but then as soon as you hit what was supposed to be like the real world outside of Westview, it went to like widescreen. Like, it was little, and which I think is indicative of like the level of care they put into a lot of different aspects of the show.
Well, and it's even things like, for I'm pretty sure that when we got to the more modern sitcoms that were in widescreen, they were in widescreen. But then when you get to the MCU stuff, it's the cinematic widescreen.
Yeah. You're right.
Yeah, he is. He is correct. Like, there's actually two different widescreens now, and Marvel they paid attention. Like, mm-hmm. If you have to give this show anything, it is attention to detail.
And a lot of that was done by, you know, we've got this duo of folks. The screenplay was done by Jack Schaefer. She hasn't done a ton of stuff, but most of the stuff she's done has been really good. Like, she did this movie called Timer. She wrote the screenplay for Olaf's Frozen Adventure, which we'll get to in a moment, because maybe this is actually Frozen 3. I'm still not sure. But she also worked on the screenplays for both Captain Marvel and Black Widow. And then they were like, look, just make this show. And then they got this guy named Matt Shakeman, who has done a lot of episode work for things like House MD, The Great, Always Sunny in Philadelphia, Fargo, Game of Thrones, a lot of stuff. He knows, you know, how to make good TV shows.
Oh, like, just such good foreshadowing from the very first episode. Okay, yeah. So I started watching with episodes 1 and 2. I don't know if they came out together. I think they did.
I think they did, yes.
But I actually knew what this story was from the very first moment, from the very first episode. I knew what this was, in part because this storyline just happened to come out during the period of time when I was working in a comic book store. So I just coincidentally... No, it didn't. No, wait, no, I... the comic book store I worked for closed down, and then the Civil War storyline happened, and this was after the Civil War story. Anyway, point being.
There's a few different comic storylines it draws a lot from. But.
Point being, this storyline happened while I was still very into Western comic books. So I was very familiar with this story as it was unfolding. In the comic books, it was not framed in the sitcom setting that it's framed in the TV show. But I immediately knew what the storyline was and was instantly very upset and sad because it's a very upsetting and sad storyline. At least it was in the comics. One of the things I really, really loved about this show is how Marvel handles that expectation of people who think they know the story already from the comic books, and how, like, it seems like consistently they manage to give us a story that is just different enough that we don't 100% know where we're going, but it's still very, very satisfying.
No, I think one of the best things that Marvel Studios is capable is taking all these decades of comic book storylines, picking some of the best ones, and then reinterpreting those things into, like, the best, you know, cinematic movie/now TV shows versions of themselves. And they did a lot, and they really, really worked hard for, you know, a lot of chunk of this show is very much based on this whole moving through various sitcoms through the decades. The essential plot is, spoilers for Endgame, the Vision died. Wanda was very, very, very sad. Next thing you know, she and Vision are these main characters in this actual real-life sitcom based on the town of Westview, New Jersey. And they're going through all these sitcoms, and they kept going through, like, the extra mile. Like, the first episode, they actually, I think possibly the first two, they filmed it in front of a live studio audience.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Like,
with a lot of NDAs involved.
Well, and then they even made sure to build, like, the studio. They built the studio as they would have built the studio back then. They researched the lighting techniques they used back then. What were the special effects used back then?
Elizabeth Olsen and Paul Bettany, they play the old sitcom stuff really good.
Yeah.
Dude, they gave him a fake butt to make sure. Yeah, like, they, like, their costumes were also incredibly period for those things. And so, like, the Spanx and stuff they had to wear more or less gave him this artificial butt that improved his posture. For when he was acting in it. There's a really good, like, short, like, one episode documentary about them making this stuff that's also on Disney Plus, and it's very, very interesting. But one of the other things that made this whole thing work really well is that for the majority of the episodes, they each have their own take on the WandaVision opening that is representative of that decade of sitcoms they're doing.
Yeah, because yeah. Didn't they do the first episodes? Weren't they, like, Bewitched and the Dick Van Dyke Show in one order or another?
Right.
Or
yeah,
something kind of like that.
Very
and
similar.
Also, and they really hit a lot of those of the sitcom tropes.
Yes.
I mean, they hit them so well. Like, and I think it's, I can't remember if it's the first episode, the boss being invited over for dinner.
Yeah.
Like, that is such that, I mean. And
Sorry to interrupt you, Charlie. But
yeah,
I have to ask: is that a thing people do? Like,
I think it's
in real life. Is that a thing people actually do?
I think it's a thing people did, like back in, like, my grandfather's day. Well, it was the same. I think it was the sort of the same impulse of inviting the preacher over for Sunday dinner,
which is also a concept I don't understand.
I think it's just like a way of engaging with the community for some people. For others, it's probably a way to, like, climb the ladder. Like, you get in good with the boss by inviting them over for dinner so that hopefully you'll get the raise. I mean, that's...
Probably these days you just go out for drinks or something. But
yeah, I know I've seen that storyline on a sitcom. I don't remember which one.
I've seen it more than once.
Yeah. And they play it so perfectly.
And that first episode, like, the way they play it off, like, it's just enough that you know that things are not as they seem, but you don't know how they're not as they seem.
Yeah.
Because I knew the storyline, I knew how they weren't what they seemed, but the pacing of it was, I thought the pacing was so incredibly perfect. Like, they didn't give you any indication that things weren't as they seemed until the end of that first episode.
Yeah.
And my brother-in-law, on the other hand, wasn't sure that he liked it because he wasn't sure that they were getting into it fast enough.
Hmm. I think you're right, though. I think they hit a very good pacing with, like, how fast do we reveal what's really going on. It's the same reason that I feel like stuff like Steven Universe or Adventure Time land so well, is because they're not throwing everything at you. They're not revealing all the secrets at once or throwing a whole lot of stuff at you that you have to remember. WandaVision is, even though it's only, what, nine episodes, it's building slowly. Like, it gives you a little teaser of what's really going on to keep you interested enough to figure out, well, what's next? I want to see what's the next reveal you're going to give me. Oh, okay. Oh, then, okay, how does that tie in? Now I have to keep watching. Like, they give you little bits without really explaining a whole lot, particularly at first, so that you are left, at least through the first few episodes, asking way more questions than you're getting answers.
Yes.
I believe one of the things I remember watching this documentary, they mentioned specifically, was they would use techniques they would use for episodes on The Twilight Zone. And they would intersperse that whenever they want to do something creepy, because that's absolutely not what the sitcom would have done.
Yeah.
So that's, but even taking, again, a nostalgic trip back to an older psychological sort of show.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so smart. And I really want to also give the music folks their due, because the openings were all scored by Robert Lopez, along with his wife, Christian Anderson Lopez. You probably knew of Robert Lopez as one of the guys who worked on things like Avenue Q, The Book of Mormon, and along with his wife, they did things like Frozen, Frozen 2, and Coco.
Yeah, it really explains why the music is just so good.
And then the score of the show itself is done by Christophine Beck, who actually was really well known first. He scored the second season of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, where he won an Emmy, but then also made it big movie scores with Bring It On, but he also did things like the Hangover trilogy, Edge of Tomorrow, so bringing it back to the good Japanese stuff. he also worked on both the Ant-Man movie scores, and that's right, Frozen 1 and 2.
So I see why your theory of this is really Frozen 3 is so...
It's all pretty much based off the music, and the screenplay writer did a one-off. But honestly, it's really shows you that Disney, like, found, like, all right, who's our most well-known now music folks? Let's let them handle this. And the music for WandaVision is just, much like everything else, so on point. And I think that's the really trick, is that I don't know... Because this wasn't even going to be, like, the first Disney Plus Marvel show that was actually supposed to be the one that we're about to start getting, which is Falcon and the Winter Soldier.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess because they knew that this one was going to be a little bit, or depending on how you look at it, a lot of it different than your traditional MCU stuff, I wonder if they knew they had to do this perfectly or else it was not going to work at all.
Yeah.
Well, they did do it perfectly, like...
Yeah, it actually, it's interesting because when they announced WandaVision, Falcon and Winter Soldier, and Loki, I was not particularly interested in any of them. And I don't even remember why I picked up WandaVision. But WandaVision completely turned me around, actually has me interested in Falcon and Winter Soldier and Loki.
Was it me possibly going on and on about just how good it was? And
it may very well have been. Like, it probably was somebody I follow on Twitter, so it probably was you.
I couldn't contain it. Like, how I was trying not to spoil it for people who hadn't seen it yet, but every episode was just so good. I liked how, like, I even began this with, yeah, I totally knew the story because I'd been reading the comics, but that only actually got me up to, like, episode, like, 3.5 or 4 before they started going in a completely different, direction with it, integrating other comics and different storylines that made more sense with the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So yeah, it was just so incredibly good, and all the groundwork that got laid in these first few episodes was just absolutely tremendous. Like, now that you have watched the whole thing, going back and rewatching the first episodes, you see just how much you missed. It's just like layer upon layer of incredibleness.
Yeah,
I do need to go back and rewatch.
I actually rewatched the whole series this morning and into the afternoon. Knowing certain twists to come later on, there's a lot of moments.
I love those.
To me, the best one is that closing. Okay, can I talk about that closing finally?
Yeah,
like, all right. It starts with, like, those three little, like, images, which, you know, are the LEDs of the old CRT televisions. Mm-hmm. They're the CRT colors. That's what those three little colors are. And so it goes over through, like, creating all different, like, important items to the storyline. And the rose got me. The rose is what made me go, oh my god, this is so insane and good. Because in the first couple of episodes, that Vision talks about, like, her roses, and so that's what you look at it and you go, oh, that's what that is, and you don't think about it anymore. That's not what it is, and they explain that. And the whole thing is just basically telling the story in very, like, concise imagery and through symbols. And you know I love it when somebody tells me a story entirely through symbolism. And that's what that closing is. If you notice, like, they even make everything out of mostly red tiles at first. Then they start mixing in. And it completely blew my mind when it suddenly occurred to me that those little LED tiles... I keep saying LED. They're not the LEDs. They're the LCDs. Those LCDs are... I recognize them as LCDs right away just because I work with colors so much that I just knew that color theory right off the bat. But... which actually blinded me to the other alternative thing going on. They're referencing the Infinity Stones and the different powers involved in the Infinity Stones. And when you go back and you look at how the items are created, you can see that mimicking, like, how the different Infinity Stones affected Wanda directly gets echoed in how the objects are put together through that ending. And oh my god, it's so good. Is my insane rant okay? Like,
you're good. You're good.
Were you able to follow it, or did I get too conspiracy theory there?
No. I mean, in fact, that theory is pretty well confirmed as you watch the show.
Yeah.
So, well, we're going to get to spoilers pretty soon, but I still want to also point out that they also did a really good job at bringing back folks from previous Marvel films and then giving them a way nicer time to shine.
Yes.
Like, for example, specifically Jimmy Woo and Darcy Lewis.
Yep. Yeah. Yes. Who I like. I love both of them in their in Ant-Man 2 and the first two Thor movies, respectively.
And man, you know, I'm really glad that, you know, Darcy really was able to get an education and is now a foremost in her field. That's awesome.
Well, I feel a little bit like Darcy may actually have taken over what the role that Thor's girlfriend was supposed to play, but...
Hmm.
Well, yeah, because she's going to be Thor now.
Well, I think Thor's girlfriend didn't... I know she had some argument with the studio, and she wouldn't come back over something. And so I feel like that's kind of why they wrote Darcy to take over that spot.
Well, and... specifically, like, Natalie Portman, when she signed on for Thor, she thought she was going to get to be a superhero.
Oh.
And then she did not. And so now, when they're about to do the new Thor movie, they went, yo, so you want to be that superhero? And she was like, hell yeah, I want to be that superhero. So, Natalie Portman's going to be Thor.
I have seen a couple behind the scenes shots. It looks like she's getting pretty buff, too. I'm kind of looking forward to it.
Okay, well, that's fantastic. That's great. I'm so happy.
She's off there busy shooting Thor 4.
Well, that's wonderful. I'm excited about that. Like, I can't explain to you how excited I am about that. Like, I'm vibrating here just thinking about it.
Really like Darcy in Thor 1 and 2. I thought she was hilarious.
Well, she was. And so, but you can see how I kind of feel like she kind of got moved into the position that Natalie Portman's character was supposed to be filling, but I feel that she's filling it better than that character was.
Yeah. Mm. She was her intern, and she's in theory, you know, also trying to be an astrophysicist.
Well, if she's moved into that role and Natalie Portman is now going to be Thor, like, I cannot express to you how excited I am about that. Like, that, like that is just the best thing ever. Okay.
But I really appreciate them bringing in these secondary characters from the MCU, including Monica Rambeau.
Also,
so you got three characters. Because what's great about that, about utilizing these characters you've already created, is that they don't have to put in legwork to make us care about these three characters.
Yeah, we've
already met them.
Yeah, it's a neat psychological trick. We also automatically care about them more because we recognize them.
Yeah. So that was a great shorthand to be able to, like, draw the audience into a story where you've got a limited amount of time to tell it. I mean, granted, more time than any of the movies would have, but much less time than a long-running series.
Gosh, it's like, you know, allowing a Marvel thing to be more serialized does well for it, considering how well it's already been doing as serialized storytelling as comics. But I would also point out that you're right. Bringing characters that we previously know is really good shorthand for us to care about them, which leads us very directly into spoilers. So we're going to take another break, and we'll be right back with spoilers for WandaVision, which works out because you probably already know the show.
Wanda was doing it all. It was all Wanda, but it was actually Agatha.
That theme song, about it was Agatha All Along theme song, did that strike anyone else as being a little like the Munsters theme song?
Yes,
a
little. Yes, that is exactly what I was thinking it was like.
Probably deliberately.
Well, yeah, and it's also, again, using the same Wanda Vision, like, it's using that same sort of thing, but they change it a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, once again, they had this really good musical hook that they did throughout, you know, with the other 80s style with, you know, Growing Pains and Full House.
Yeah.
And then just straight up just doing Malcolm in the Middle. And got an actual, like, lady punk rock band to do that for them. And then the one that was pretty much The Office, like...
Okay, yeah. I have to ask, though, so everything was pretty much like an amalgamation of sitcoms typical of the era up until the Malcolm in the Middle episode. Why? Do you guys know?
I assumed it was because, like, Malcolm in the Middle is a big shift in the type of sitcom storytelling. Kind of like how... Because then you got The Office one... Which is also like a huge shift in style of sitcom. Because I feel like 50s through the 80s, sitcoms don't change too much in the way they're presenting their stories. But with Malcolm in the Middle, you get the breaking of the fourth wall type stuff, which then evolves into the mockumentary style of The Office, Parks and Rec, whatever else. So
Modern Family.
Yeah. So that's just an assumption on my part. Is that they're channeling a very specific huge shift in storytelling style in the genre. So they're sticking to like what is the epitome of that, either the first of that style or the epitome of that style, but that's just a guess on my part.
Well, also remember, this was really where they showed off the twins.
Yeah.
And so having something at their level was also really good visual shorthand to get you in where they're at. And I think Malcolm in the Middle was just like the perfect sitcom to base things off of.
Yeah, even though I will say I was super sad that there wasn't a very direct Full House episode. I was really counting. Honestly, when Quicksilver shows up at the end of like the 80s episode, I guess it was.
Yeah.
I was so sure in my bones that the next episode was definitely going to be like a full-on Full House parody.
Well, Full House because... was also like really also 80s as well.
Like, yeah. So
they actually, and they directly reference at least a couple of Full House moments in the opening for that episode.
Yeah. But the reason was, like, I always felt like when I saw Quicksilver, I was like, this is definitely like an Uncle Joey, Uncle, I can't remember the other's uncle's Jesse. Name, Uncle Jesse kind of character. And the fact that you've got an Olsen actually on the show.
Like... Well, I also wonder if they didn't want to go too hard on that because
they had an actual Olsen.
And they probably wanted, again, but and also Full House itself is not the storytelling shift, is not the storytelling sort of epic shift that Malcolm in the Middle is. So Malcolm in the Middle probably better represents the 90s and allows you to evolve into the mockumentary style. So, I mean, I can see why, because if you did a full-on Full House episode, it would probably read a lot like the 80s episode. So it wouldn't be a huge difference.
Well, to me, the 90s shows that I was really, I'm sad I didn't get to see an approximation of was Fresh Prince, Family Matters, and... Saved by the Bell were all like the 90s shows that live in my heart. And it occurs to me that I think there's not really a way to differentiate those shows with this cast of characters.
Yeah, because those shows with who the protagonist is. Well, Family Matters would have been the easiest one, I think.
Yeah, Family Matters they could have done.
Fresh Prince is just... Who the story is really about is so different, because what they still have to keep in the forefront is that this needs to be about Wanda and Vision.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then as they have so the kids, really
the
their
family. Sitcom, which, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Fresh Prince of Bel-Air is pretty much family sitcom, but it's that one but is so unique to the characters involved in it.
Yes. And like, because that show is not like the nuclear family type setting that yeah. Fresh Prince is a very extended family kind of show, so it would be hard to really like reference Fresh Prince heavily in the setting that you're already in, that you have to be in because you've already established your characters.
And this is also to the point where we have now also very much have seen the MCU side of things, and now these episodes kind of have to play both to the sitcominess as it's transitioning to just full on MCU-ness.
Because, like, okay, I mean, hopefully you've seen it if you're listening to spoilers.
Is Marvel possibly making a commentary about its own status as our current sitcom?
I don't know.
Anyway, go on, Kevin.
Well, let's say, you know, since this is spoilers, you know, what turns out is Wanda has basically trapped an entire city in her own little personal sitcom fantasy world with an extent of power hitherto not seen from the character within the cinematic universe.
And a mental breakdown not hitherto seen in this character.
Or the cinematic universe.
Yeah.
Except for maybe Iron Man's PTSD in Iron Man 3, which was a good movie.
It was a good movie. I don't know why people don't like that one. Iron Man 3 is great. Anyways.
But it also shows you they really wanted to also drive in just how much that Wanda has actually grown up on sitcoms. Sitcoms was actually her window and her war-torn nation that she grew up in. Her family watching sitcoms was like the moments of happiness she had with her family, gathering around the CRT and watching those diodes fire. Like,
whew, that's some heavy stuff.
Old Dick Van Dyke, Malcolm in the Middle, you know, all the stuff they directly reference in the show.
Yeah.
So it's like,
there's also a lot of interesting, like, who is the bad guy? Because it's like, particularly when it first starts off, there's this shift because and we haven't mentioned it yet, the show has fake commercials in it.
Yeah.
But the fake commercials tend to reference, well, at least the first two, I don't know about all of them, but at least the first two or three commercials definitely reference Marvel villains. Because the first one is like Zemo brand something, which is a reference to Baron Zemo. There's a reference, the other one's like Hydra something. And so, like, I feel like it first leads you start thinking, okay, this is somehow Hydra's involved in this. And then there's the shift to, well, Wanda's in, it's all, or maybe the shift is then to the guy that's heading S.W.O.R.D. You start thinking maybe he's behind this somehow, and then it's to, oh, Wanda's behind the whole thing. And then it's, well, yes, but not only.
Yes, but no, but.
Yeah, yes, but
yes.
Not. So there was also that it kept you guessing, like who actually is the bad guy? Like, I kept expecting, honestly, that the guy from S.W.O.R.D. was going to have had a much bigger role in what was going on in Westview, not just...
I mean, he's a villain, but he's more an opportunistic villain. Just happened to have... Things have lined up for him in a good way to enact what he was kind of already trying to do.
Yeah, exactly.
People were theorizing pretty heavily that... Mephisto was going to be making an appearance, and I still have not ruled that possibility out, but I don't think he was as major a player as people who knew the comic book storyline would have guessed.
Maybe they're saving him for Doctor Strange.
I feel like Mephisto is one of those villains that you have to lead up to.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, he's not one you just throw in. Like, he's too big of an enemy. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like how, I mean, I don't know if it's like the level of like Thanos, like the amount of time they spent building him up, kind of a thing. Like, he's going to be like the big bad of an entire phase. But I do feel like that's one that you have to take care with how you use, because you've only got so many bad guys of that stature. And
to be fair, a lot of the Marvel villains have had an unfortunate tendency to show up and be dead before their movie's over.
Yeah, like you need to have an antagonist in every superhero movie. Like, you don't need to, but the audience will be very upset with you if you don't have one somewhere. You need to have one villain per movie, one antagonist per movie. But then, like, these Thanos-level characters are just really satisfying when they pay off, but by their nature, they have to be very limited. And so I think you're exactly right. I think this is the beginning of the build-up towards Mephisto.
It yeah. could be. Because I really don't know who they're building up. I mean,
I've heard rumors they're going to try to work in Kang the Conqueror, but I think he's more towards Ant-Man end of the production schedule.
Yeah. Because, well, I mean, and looking at the movies that are coming up, they're a little all over the place. Like, I don't see a common thread. I mean, obviously, we've not really seen any of them yet. But I take it that Mandarin is going to be a villain in one of them. I don't know who the villain in Doctor Strange and the Realms of Madness is going to be.
That's why I'm thinking maybe Mephisto, because Doctor Strange almost has to fight something magical.
Well,
I think you're right.
He doesn't have to, but it seems like...
And he's already done Dormammu, so it's...
Well, he's already done Dormammu is exactly why I think that... I think that in this Doctor Strange movie, we're going to start see the rising of Mephisto. Yeah. I don't think Mephisto is going to be the bad guy of Doctor Strange, but I do think we're going to, like, by the end of Doctor Strange, we're going to have our reveal of, it's Mephisto!
It could be, because, and this is something we've not touched on yet, in WandaVision, Agatha Harkness has the line, you don't know what you've unleashed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's because
they definitely touch on a bunch of the supernatural side of the Marvel Comics universe.
Yes, then this was a big this was a big shift too, because previously Wanda's powers were said to be the result of the Infinity Stone that she came into contact with, and this shifted it. And it's up until Doctor Strange came out, they've been. It seemed like the Marvel MCU was very careful to just frame magic as technology we don't understand.
Right, like that was the whole Thor thing originally.
Exactly.
Was,
so
was
that seemed to be
as high
and
technology.
And that seemed to be what they were focusing on. And then with Doctor Strange, and that's going into Doctor Strange. I was like, well, they're gonna do the same thing they did in Thor, and they didn't. They were just, oh, it's magic.
Like,
and
nope,
then
magic, dude. It's just
and
weird.
They've really, yeah, because they've really pretty much ignored the magic side of the Marvel Universe. So it was interesting to see WandaVision sort of reversing sort of some of what Thor was doing, where instead of just calling all magic technology or something to that effect, they're saying, oh no, Wanda actually had this power. It was... Or to some extent, it was just unlocked and enhanced by the Infinity Stone.
Right. Yeah.
So that was an interesting reveal.
And I think, especially with the Doctor Strange movie and some of these other ones, it seems like they might want to lean into the magic side more.
Yeah.
Because remember, the Infinity Stones was really it wasn't so much Thanos that was the big buildup. It was the Infinity Stones that were the big buildup.
Which,
it just so happened to be the antagonist they were using with the Infinity Stones.
Which, by the way, I went through, because of WandaVision, I found some infographics that other people have put together of timelines of the MCU and where all the different Infinity Stones were throughout the entire timeline of the movies. And as it came to, I forget what happened in WandaVision that made me think about this. I think it was as they were going through, like, how Wanda's exposure created her powers and yada, yada, yada. But Wanda Maximoff has actually been involved with, like, 5 out of 6 of the Infinity Stones in one way or another.
Mm.
Like she has had near direct contact with 5 of them.
Yeah.
And, like, if you think about that, actually does really set her in a position to be possibly one of the most powerful characters in the universe.
Well, and that was another
kind
reveal.
Of is even in the like it's kind of weird because then when she first showed up in the comics is with like Magneto and the League of Evil Mutants, all she could really do is just kind of give you bad luck.
But the, and this like, was another reveal, though. Yeah, this was another reveal in WandaVision. It was just a line that Agatha threw off, I believe, which was that the Scarlet Witch is more powerful than the Sorcerer Supreme.
Yes.
Which also led me to believe that we're going to see Scarlet Witch in the next Doctor Strange movie.
Which we will.
But
they've already said.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
We will or we won't. I didn't hear.
Like,
but okay. that definitely goes along with saying that Scarlet Witch has become quite possibly one of the most powerful forces in the MCU.
Did you see her in the post credit scene doing the Doctor Strange thing of reading the book while she was hanging out doing other stuff?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize that was a reference to Doctor Strange.
Yeah, that was directly a reference to Doctor Strange. I think it went over a lot of people's head. That's what it was a reference to.
Yeah, that was the thing he was doing. He was astral projecting while sleeping to keep studying. She was doing other things while astral projecting and studying.
Yeah.
But which all right. is,
we got a lot of questions to get through, though. So let's take another break. Because I think a lot of stuff we're talking about will go right into the questions that people have asked us.
Okay. Okay.
Well, all righty then.
We got something cooking and it's looking good. We got something cooking and knew we could.
All right, we are back with questions from listeners like you. We're going to start off with our buddy Nico over at Nico Scream. Personal favorite sitcom era. Which episode best captured the era specific sitcom feel? Note, Charlie believes this is a very sexy question.
Yes, from a person who has... And a question from a person who has ridiculous taste because he thinks there should be a single space after periods instead of a double space.
You are technically correct, sir, as we all know, that is the best kind of correct.
Exactly. So Nico's barely human, but it is a sexy question. And my personal answer is probably the 50s or 60s. The first two episodes, I just think, maybe it's because I watched a good bit of Dick Van Dyke Show and Bewitched back in the day, but... and although I will say the Malcolm in the Middle and the Office ones are very good... I for some reason the 50s and 60s ones just kind of like hit this sitcom sweet spot for me.
Well, personally I love the mockumentary era of sitcoms and I think I answered it already that my favorite era of sitcoms is actually the late 90s early 2000s era. Mm. And so I'm a little bit sad that we didn't see see that in WandaVision because it skipped over that to go on to Malcolm in the Middle. I do like of the eras that they did cover, I do really like the mockumentary style, but I agree with you that I think the 50s and 60s did the best job of encapsulating that feel. It felt like watching an episode of Dick Van Dyke and then yes.
Maybe it's just because they played those the straightest up to like the tail ends of the episodes. Like, it was just like, we just made an episode of the Dick Van Dyke Show for shits and giggles. You could make that argument.
I think you're definitely right. That definitely plays into it, that there's the least interaction with sort of the quote-unquote real MCU world, where it's just kind of the straight sitcom with just a few weird things thrown in. You're like, what the heck's going on?
You ever wonder if Elizabeth Olsen and Paul Bettany could just do episodes of the Dick Van Dyke Show if they wanted to? Well, yes, they could.
Turns out.
They were so good, though. I really liked them, and it really made me excited when I thought, oh, this is just like Bewitched! I loved that show! And then as I was watching it, I was going, oh, wait, this is a little bit more like I Dream of Jeannie. Like, I still really loved how well they did that. That was just so fantastic.
Yep.
Yeah, as someone who very much grew up on Nick at Night, Yeah. Like, those were so just, mwah. Like, it was so, so good. I also kind of really wonder if the 80s show, the 90s sitcoms very felt just much like a more polished version of the 80s.
Well, that's true. And a lot of people who study, how do I put it? People
sitcomology?
Who study, not sitcomology, but people who study, like, current, not current events, but recent history, I guess is the best way to put it. Like, the people who go back and look over the historical stuff that happened in, like, the past couple of decades have commented and made note that you have this distinct character for the 50s, you have this distinct American character for the 60s, this distinct American character for the 70s, but the 90s is real. While we thought the 90s was its own unique thing, it was really more of a continuation of the 80s from, like, an economic and cultural standpoint.
And I just don't know if WandaVision could be Seinfeld. Okay. So, the next two questions from Nico and also from our friend Austin at Bebop Shock are more or less the same question.
Oh, okay.
Where Nico mentions the boner twist, upset about the show trolling everyone, or find it hilarious. Austin, boy, was that Evan Peters Quicksilver a big old nothing burger or what?
Okay, this is another one that I have thought about a lot, and I have an answer. I do think it was an intentional troll, and I think you have to be very careful when you do intentional trolling like this. Because they did so much that was very much intentional. There was so much. There's so much stuff just packed in there for the audience to notice. That by the time they did that Quicksilver reveal, we were all just like racing to figure out the hidden meanings of everything, of every little nuanced thing in that show. So when they present something that's pretty obviously a big nod to something, we kind of deserved it.
Well, I thought it was absolutely amazing because I think it was done in the service of one of the most time-tested sitcom tropes, which is replacing a character with another actor and pretending like nothing happened.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I think that's 100% of the reason they did it is that, oh, you know what trope we've not done is a character gets replaced by another actor, and everybody has to pretend like it's the same person. And Quicksilver was just, it's the only choice you could have made. Yeah. And it doesn't hurt that I feel like, as far as your Quicksilver characters go, the X-Men franchise Quicksilver is a more likable character. He was around for more movies.
More people are likely to recognize him as Quicksilver right off the bat.
Yeah,
when
and
he shows up.
He was just a better Quicksilver.
And if you're going to play him as like the cool uncle type character, it's definitely going to be the X-Men version of Quicksilver and not the Marvel version of Quicksilver.
And they
I think they had to do it that way for a very specific reason. So
it also did a good job of distracting us so that we weren't paying too much attention to other stuff that they were pulling in the background. While we were focused on, is this going to be the tie-in into multiple universes for the Marvel universe?
Is this how we're going to get X-Men?
Yeah. While we were all focused on that, it gave us something to salivate over while they put things in place and that are still there, and we can still go back there and enjoy them and look at it and admire the nice foreshadowing. But at the time and in the heat of the moment, while we had to fixate on something, it gave us something to fixate on.
Yeah, it was a beautiful misdirect.
Yes.
I also really like how he actually is the Ralph that Agnes keeps talking about throughout the show.
Yes. This was going back to, but it was really dangerous, and they really, I'm glad they pulled it off so masterfully as they did, because whenever you do that, it's a really big gamble, because not being satisfying is not always better than Like, surprising us is not always more satisfying than letting us guess the right thing.
And yeah. They did a very good job of, by and large, keeping everything contained within the show.
And quickly to Austin's point, or to Austin's question, is if it's a nothing burger, like, what did you want? Like, what would have been your expectation that could have been realistic? Because the only thing I can think of would be, like Doug mentioned, some sort of multiverse tie-in to the X-Men franchise, which I don't see them. If it ever happens, I don't think this is the way they would do it. So, I mean, I think it just was what it was. Like, I didn't necessarily expect some great reveal from it, like some huge, like, franchise-wide reveal out of it or something like that.
Well, I really did like it. I really was a big fan of it.
Yeah, me too.
is the bottom line.
It was so beautifully done. But we can move on.
Okay, yes.
So, on another note, I'm glad WandaVision was a very personal, more down-to-earth story in the grand scheme of the Marvel Universe. What other characters do you think could benefit from the TV treatment, apart from what Disney has already announced, like Loki, Falcon, Winter Soldier, etc.?
That's a tough one.
Well, okay, so I feel that this is not... I feel like this is not the TV treatment. It did have a lot of reasons why it benefited from being a TV show, and part of it is this slow rollout and slow reveal. But I think there are just tons of other characters in the Marvel Cinematic Universe that would benefit from this. Like, I think the way they have Peter Parker set up, like, he's perfect for just, like, a villain of the week type Spider-Man.
Yeah, I could see that. The problem is, if you look at the ones they've done, or planning to do, mm-hmm. they're all characters that were part of an ensemble cast that never got their own movie. So, when he asks, like, what other characters do you think could benefit, the ones that are that could possibly get it are never, because my first thought was Ant-Man, because that's a very down-to-earth character, but we've already gotten two movies. The same with Peter Parker, even though it's very down-to-earth. Go ahead.
The answer is Jimmy Woo.
Yes!
Honestly?
Well, yeah.
Well, that or Monica Rambeau, but I feel like Monica Rambeau, they're probably setting her up for something major.
Captain Marvel, I'm betting.
Yeah, they feel like
Captain Marvel.
Or Secret Wars.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the character that would get it would have to be somebody like Jimmy Woo or a superhero character from a more ensemble cast. And I honestly,
I'm going to go with an oddball pick. I'd like to see more of Ghost, who was the sort of villain from Ant-Man and the Wasp.
That could be good. Or War Machine.
Yeah, War Machine.
But Don Cheadle, that'd be a hard get, I think, for a series. Well, then again, I never would have thought they would get... And that was a huge part of WandaVision, is they... You know, in years past, a miniseries spinoff would have been no-name actors playing the same character. The fact that they actually had Paul Bettany and Olsen playing those characters was huge. So I guess they could probably... Disney's got the money for Don Cheadle, but...
And honestly,
Don Cheadle was Donald Duck.
Give me all the random supporting characters, just mix and match them with the other series. Just have them, like, wander into each other's universes.
And we'll call it WandaVision.
Oh, no.
Like,
moving on.
Spider-Man buddy hang out with Ant-Man for some reason, you know? Like, have Ant-Man's gang end up having to work with whatever they do with Black Panther. I don't know. Just mix them up.
So, I think Tori, at Worst Waifu on Twitter, more or less has, like, the best wrap-up question, although, Bill, I haven't forgotten about you. Do you think Wanda was truly a villain? I can't blame her for what she did, though I'm glad she came to her senses in the end. Would you do the same for a loved one? If I had infinite cosmic magical witch power, probably.
Mm-hmm. Well, same. I once chose in a video game to destroy a small town just so two girls might get together. So, yeah, I'm not the best one to ask what to do with infinite power.
I think that Wanda does count as a villain in this situation, But this is exactly how why when we say that villains can be sympathetic and well-written villains.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really blur the line. And, she and... is still a villain because she did still hold this entire town hostage. Mm-hmm. It was still a very unpleasant experience for this whole town. And she did it by accident. But that's a really dangerous thing to just let go with no consequences.
Right. There was definitely a point. Was sad. There was definitely a point that was reached, though, where she was conscious of what was going on, and
chose
she
to do
chose
it anyway.
Chose to keep it continuing.
Go ahead.
So I was. For me, it was a case of yeah, but I think she thought she was also stuck in it.
Yeah.
Like it was so running, and she wasn't sure what would happen if she were to just stop. Would it hurt them as well? Like there's a lot more to it, and I think a lot of the trick with Agatha is that as the nosy neighbor and whatnot, she was sort of helping keeping it going. Like yeah. I kind of wonder with her interfering, it kept Wanda from realizing, oh no, I should stop this.
Yeah. Well, it's a little bit of the Matrix problem of if it was too perfect, Wanda would have figured it out too quickly and would have decided no. But when you Wanda would have probably figured it out and shut it down more quickly, but when you put in a little bit of distress or you keep it just good enough, a certain percentage of the population will choose to just be comfortable forever.
And I was not in the Doug camp until Doug started talking, and then I fell into the Doug camp of, yes, Wanda is a villain. And my reasoning is Wanda is a villain for the same reason that Thanos is. Both
like
of them are coming from sympathetic places, but their actions put them in a very bad place. And also, the show makes a point of showing the fallout of like how the people that live in Westview, how they view Wanda.
Yeah, now that she's done this. You know, those people will never be able to sit there and be happy with superheroes ever again. Now it's always going to be in the back of their mind, oh God, mm-hmm. what can these hyper-powerful people just do? Which is already alluded to in the MCU with, like, the Sokovia Accords. Like, they've already started to take this into account as a deconstruction of superheroes. But WandaVision just kind of cranks that up to 11, I guess.
I'll be really curious to see, since we know that she's going to be in the Doctor Strange movie, what ends up being the repercussions of WandaVision in that film, if there is any.
She very much could end up being the antagonist of the Doctor Strange movie. I hope she's not, but she could be.
Well, it could also be that sort of format of antagonist who, once beaten, becomes a protagonist.
Yeah, like
the Naruto style.
The Scarlet Witch herself in the comics has really gone back and forth on the whole hero villain thing a few times.
That's true.
Yeah. I hope that Wanda gets a redemption arc. Like, she needs to be redeemed. And while it's very understandable what she did and is very sympathetic, it's still villainous.
Yeah, and I think
it's not
a
good thing.
And I think we've got a couple other storylines, because there's going to be where does Wanda show up and how. There's going to be where does Monica show up and how. We've got a new Vision on the loose.
How does he show up?
Yeah, where's he going to show up and how? Because now he has...
Or is he the original Vision?
Well, yes and no, but he now has the Vision's memories, and then you've also got the allusion to, of Agatha's allusion to, you don't know what you've unleashed, which makes it sound like, okay, the build-up for phase whatever we're going to be in is going to be a magical villain. Like, there's several elements here that are going to be...
And will we see Wanda's kids again?
And just say,
Don't even get me started on that. That was the single saddest moment.
We're running out of time, y'all. We don't have time to go into this. This is a whole new can of worms.
When I told you guys at the very beginning that this storyline was a sad storyline, and I got upset the moment I saw her prego belly, and I just started crying.
I
knew those kids don't make it.
Yeah. Right now in the comics, her kids are super important. so I don't think we've seen the last of them.
Yeah, they came back after I kind of petered out of comic book fandom, so that's why I was surprised that they're still around, but...
They are super important right now. At least one of them is.
Yeah, I didn't know that they were... I didn't know that they came back in later on storylines, but I am glad to hear that they do, and I hope that they come back in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It would make sense for them to come back.
And we're going to wrap up with Bill at WE Foreman 999 asking, best or favorite theme song from the TV series?
All of them.
I mean, many ways are all the same theme. They're just different iterations of the same theme.
Yep.
I mean, can I choose Agatha All Along?
One of us was going to.
That's true. Honestly, that might be my pick, too.
Mine is the end credits one.
Mm, I see that.
Like, the one that stays the same the whole time. That's my favorite one.
I think for me, it was the 80s one. And maybe it's the Too Many Cooks. Of it, where, like, that was a theme song where you could definitely tell things were starting to go awry, but they are going awry in the theme song.
It was a little bit Too Many Cooks, wasn't it?
It was. Yeah. It was just a little bit. Okay, so you thought questions were over, but no. In fact, our buddy Elvis sent us something right as we were done recording, so I'm with my wonderful wife and our editor, Anna.
Hi.
Finish off a couple of extra questions from Michael Ramos, a.k.a. Cyber Elvis. Where the heck did White Vision go?
I guess to contemplate his mission to destroy the Vision, but he's also the Vision, so does he destroy himself?
And they sort of kind of covered the whole Ship of Theseus thing that, well, you'll find out later on the episode. What is the Scarlet Witch? Is it C'thon? Mephisto? Something new? I assume the Scarlet Witch is the Scarlet Witch.
Yeah, the fact that there was a whole, like, entry in the Darkhold about her, sort of, she's her own entity.
Yeah, so I guess we'll see. I mean, I'm sure we'll find out more in this upcoming movie of the Doctors and Strange and Multiverses and Madness and all that fun stuff, but really... How did Gabriel Luna's Ghost Rider lose the Darkhold? Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. will always be canon in my heart. Me too. I believe the actor was like, oh, sorry about that. That's my bad. I just left it on the bed or something.
I mean, maybe this is how we get Coulson back. Maybe Coulson went and got it and brought it and was like, here, let's have some fun. And I don't know. I just want Coulson back.
Yeah. Who knows? Maybe we will. Maybe we won't. Maybe we'll do a whole different Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. with Coulson. Or without Coulson. I don't know. I do miss Coulson. Man, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. was a really good show. And I am a little bit, actually a lot of it salty, that they're not incorporating more of that show into now the Marvel Cinematic Universe stuff with TVs or movies when they have so much. But now I need to know, how many awesomes out of awesome are you going to give WandaVision?
I'm going to give it the three CRT colors of awesome.
6 decades of sitcoms at awesome.
I'm going to say more awesome than the Sorcerer Supreme awesome.
Wow, that's a lot of awesome.
I'm going to give this as the theoretical second show that was supposed to kick off Phase 4. But yet, it feels very much like this show should have been the one to kick off Phase 4 out of awesome. So, thank y'all very much. Well, it's also, you know, it's a case of, now, what does, you know, Falcon Winter Soldier bring to the table? That's now interesting. If WandaVision was supposed to be the second salvo, and now it's the entry salvo, what is it about this other show that was supposed to lead us into this new phase? But anyways, this is the Awesome Cast, your podcast for everything awesome. Thank y'all very much for listening. Our theme song was made by DJ Inabito. You can find him at djinabito.com. He also twitches on Twitch as DJ Inabito. Also, our compatriot John, along with Dylan and Mike and other folks, twitch at VZRVG for These Are Video Games. You can find the Awesome Cast online at awesomecast.com. As we've mentioned up top, we've got a Patreon, we've got a Discord. If you don't want to give us money, you should give us money. But if you don't, that's cool. Join the Discord. Talk to us. We're friendly folks. We have an amazing food channel with all sorts of awesome food pictures from people like Dylan and Charlie and Jen and Anna and all wonderful folks make excellent foods. And they post them for my and your amusement if you join.
Like, comment, subscribe, blood sacrifice.
Yeah. To the Darkhold, even though you killed Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., I guess, or something weird. I'm a little bit mad about that, but this is not the podcast for that anymore. Anyways, this show's been edited by Anna, who is awesome and amazing. You can find her...
And waiting to raid.
At Angel Fire, the Middle Age Silent.
I doubt she's waiting.
You can find me on Twitter at It's Basil Time. Kevin's got twitless_Kevin. Charlie's at the_sommelier. Doug, you can find on Redbubble and buy some sweet t-shirts at Redbubble/Umitsu. Thank y'all very much for listening, and we'll be back next time.
Who's been messing up everything?
It's been Agatha all along.
Who's been pulling every evil string?
It's been Agatha all along.
She's the insidious, so perfidious that you haven't even noticed. And the pity is. It's too late to fix anything now that everything has gone wrong. Thanks to Agatha, naughty Agatha.
It's been Agatha all along.
And I killed Sparky too.
But I have to ask, before we go, if all the awesome casters, one by one, changed out to different people, would it still be the awesome cast? And if all those original podcasters got back together under a different title, would that be the awesome cast?